Hello, and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be talking all about the Catiline Conspiracy, a very specific moment in time in ancient Rome, in about 63-62 AD, BC rather. And I'll be in conversation with Elizabeth Heverin. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. So you've recently been published in, what was the magazine you were published in?
The Critic.
The Critic, yeah, with a very good article about the Gracchi brothers. Mm-hmm. Something I've written about myself. So you've got an interest in the ancient world and you know, got knowledge about the ancient world. Mm-hmm. So just before we start, how come? Why do you like the ancient world? What is it that's fascinating to you?
I particularly, when it comes to the ancient world, I'm quite fascinated with the Roman Republic specifically. Right. I think there's a lot of patterns within the Republican world and our own time today, particularly the corruption and the consequences of that when it came to governmental life. I'm quite interested in the circular theory of the Republic, how you have this great civilization that comes by overthrowing this tyrant of a monarch. It's then built on virtue, and men seem to place their country first and seem to place virtue first rather than their self-interest. And then after a series of wars, with Carthage, the Rome becomes corrupted with wealth, and it's that decline and fall that I'm most interested in. But I also, studying the Roman Republic sort of brings me hope in the sense that the Republic doesn't die and fall apart. Instead, something better comes from its ashes, which is the Roman Empire.
Right.
So it's like this circular theory of we're so over, but in the end we're so back.
You think something similar might happen with the United States, the great republic of our age?
I think throughout history, even after the Roman Republic, we've seen the circular theory of civilizations repeat themselves. So, for example, one which applies most in Britain is the rise and decline of the Britons after the Roman Empire. And we see that throughout history with different royal family is taking power and then falling, and then other royal families come and take their place. So I think we're really living in the decline of another circular theory of civilization in our own time. Mm. And what will come from the ashes is to be debated.
Right.
And we can find these answers looking into the past, which is why the Roman Republic is so fascinating.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting point you point out there. I mean, we'll be talking all about Cicero, old Tully, in this episode, and he's someone who said exactly that: if you remain ignorant of your past, you're forever to remain a child and doomed to repeat the failures of the past if you're not aware of the pitfalls that we've already gone through. So another thing you mentioned there that is interesting and will come up in our story, what about this concept of that your civilization is in decline, or that men are more degenerate, mankind is more degenerate and venal than they used to be. Mm-hmm. And that theme comes up in this, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because even by the 60s BC in Rome, so, you know, after Sulla, but before Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. So just to put it in context real quick, Sulla dies in what, like 78 BC, I think. And the events we're going to be talking about is 62 and 63 BC. So it's about 15 years after Sulla dies. But we're not really into the age of Julius Caesar yet. He's a very, very junior politician, isn't he? Mm-hmm. It's sort of the rise of Pompey. Pompey's sort of the main guy, right? One of the most powerful people in Rome at this moment. So, yeah, the 60s BC. And even at that point, the Republic had this feeling, don't you think, of men used to be stronger and more virtuous and better mm-hmm. in the past. Even just like two generations ago, we were better two generations ago. And now everyone's sleeping around and committing all sorts of crimes mm-hmm. and our whole civilization is going to pot.
Yeah.
Did you get that feeling reading the sources?
Yeah, precisely. I think, for example,
Sallust.
Right. He sort of talks about in the opening of his work on the Catiline conspiracy about when he enters public office, he's sort of tempted by all these vices because there's so much vice within the Senate and within those in power. That he says in the end it makes him jealous of those who hold more power than him. Mm-hmm. And you sort of see that. It's this great wealth that comes into Rome that corrupts people's character. No longer is it about what can I do for my country. It's more of what can my country do for me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Solis puts it quite great when he says that men no longer make friends for merit. They instead only care for friendships if it's in their self-interest. And, right. and that's really what you see in the 60s BC.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, that men used to have virtues and principles that they would stand on, come mm-hmm. what may. And now everyone's just in the business of bribing their way into office and not doing the right thing when they get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you mentioned Sallust then. So we have to. I'd like to say a quick few words right at the beginning, as I usually do, about the sources. So we're actually sort of got an embarrassment of riches in a way when it comes to the Catiline conspiracy. There's a reason why people who don't know their Roman history might not ever have heard of the Catiline conspiracy. But if you have and you know your Roman history, it's one of the highlights, right? It's one of the more famous events. And it's quite a small period of time we're talking about, like less than a year from start to finish, right? So it's a fairly tight focus here. And we've got, Plutarch, there's the life of Cicero in Plutarch,
mm-hmm.
but Plutarch also talks about the Catiline conspiracy in passing in other places. We've got Sallust, who did a whole small, very, very small book all about it. I've got my Sallust here. We'll be quoting from it. I think you've got some quotes. And also Cicero himself, not just his speeches. He sort of famously made three, or is it four orations attacking Catiline? Four?
Yeah, I think
he did. Okay, the first one's the most important, famous one. So they survived to us incredibly. So we've got the actual speeches of Cicero, and Sallust is a contemporary. He was alive at the time, as was Cicero, obviously. And then we've got Plutarch. What else we got? Dio, Cassius Dio talks a bit about it. And Appian, of course, talks a bit about it. So in one sense, we've got loads of information, right? For an ancient event in ancient history, that's loads of different sources. You would think that's great. Well, it is great. If you go back to something like Herodotus, he might mention someone once in passing, and that's it. That's all the literary evidence we've got about something, full stop. So when it comes to the Catiline conspiracy, we've got lots and lots of information, but perhaps it's too much, really, because a lot of the sources are, most scholars and historians agree, completely biased. We're getting one side of the story, aren't we? We're getting Cicero's side of the story only. Sallust is a massive Cicero fan, or a pretty big Cicero fan, certainly an enemy of, politically, of Catiline. So we've got a lot, but it's very dodgy ground. Do you know all about this debate surrounding the sources?
Yeah, I do. But I think, you know, the fact that these sources remain, you know, they was quite popular for their age sort of illustrates what most of the majority of men thought of Catiline.
Mm.
I think in his first speech, I think Cicero puts it quite well. He puts, nobody in the Senate greets you anymore, and you sit by yourself. If I was you, I would, you know, flee Rome in shame. And you know, although Cicero may be heavily biased, I think that speech alone sort of illustrates what the rest of the Senate thinks of Catiline. No one ever brings up any admirable qualities or anything great he's done in his life. It's more, he's more of this representation of a life of shame and degeneracy and everything to avoid.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, like no one wants to sit with you, Catiline. Like on the unpopular kids' table at lunch at school, there's just the one kid on his own that no one wants to sit near. Yeah, so, I mean, let's get into it then. So let's talk about Catiline. Who was Catiline? Who is Catiline? Because if I could say a little bit more about the sources, it's in Cicero's interest politically to paint Catiline to be as bad as possible. And once we tell you the story and how it all plays out, you'll know why that is.
Mm-hmm.
But just to say, it's in his interest to make Catiline to be as evil and monstrous as possible. Sallust is on that bandwagon. Plutarch is a bit fairer, but he's still much more of a fan of Cicero than he is of Catiline. So the image we get from all the sources is that he's just terrible, just a black and white, terrible person. There's nothing redeeming about him. There's nothing good about him. Now, most serious historians, when you get a picture of someone coming back to you through time like that, you have to question it, right? You have to be, most people aren't usually that bad. You might get the odd person, like, I don't know, Joseph Mengele or something, or Stalin, or not even Stalin. I was going to say someone with no redeemable features, but it's very, very rare, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of historians have said maybe what we're being told about Catiline is an exaggeration. But so let's start off. So who is he? He's a senator, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And he's expelled from running. Was he expelled from running for council in 65 and 64 BC because of bribery,
yeah,
and stuff like that? So I suppose that's more concrete evidence. You know, the fact that he's expelled, which shows that he really is not the most admirable politicians, and the crowd that he sort of surrounds himself and sort of people in the Senate who backs his campaign are all people who are expelled for immorality, corruption, bribery. They're all figures that are sort of like him in the sense of their vices. So I think that alone sort of illustrates again that Catiline is somebody that most certainly surrounds himself with corrupt and fights for people.
Mm, yeah. We're told in all the sources that he keeps company with bad people.
Yeah.
Right? The worst of people.
The lowest
corrupt
of the
politicians. So, again, what we're going to talk about, the conspiracy, Catiline's conspiracy, the events really take place in 63 and into 62 BC, and we count down because we're in BC, of course. But in the previous years, I think 66 and 65 BC, Catiline had tried to become consul and failed, had lost the election. So the things we have to get into there to sort of put meat on the bones for anyone who doesn't know is that Rome at this stage is fantastically corrupt. Mm-hmm. You could only really win these high offices like a praetor or an aedile or something or the consulship through loads of bribery. There's sort of no other way. There's different civilizations throughout history where it's normalized.
Mm-hmm.
Where everyone knows it's corrupt and you're not supposed to be bribing people, but everyone's doing it. Everyone knows it's going on. You stand no chance if you don't do it. So it's still illegal, but it's normalised.
Yeah. I think earlier in Cicero's career, there's a law that's wanting to be passed where they want to banish any politician who bribes from the Senate. And I think Cicero says, well, if you do that, half of us will just be gone.
Yeah.
So it's something that is extremely normalised to the point where no one really knows how to overcome the problem whatsoever.
Yeah. No, it's completely endemic by this point, where especially for the highest ones, the praetorships and the consulships, if you want to run for it, unless you happen to be fantastically rich in your own right, like someone like Crassus, unless you're that, which is at all times hardly anyone, mm-hmm. right? Unless you're that, you will have to borrow loads of money in order to bribe your way into office.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's what Julius Caesar does. That's what all sorts of people do.
And that's what Catiline
had to have done. So everyone's doing it. It just depends whether you've got enough enemies that will try and prosecute you for it if you fail,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's one of the foundational things to this story, is that Catiline has borrowed sort of insane sums of money in order to bribe his way into office, which he then failed to do. So then you're in a tough spot at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Julius Caesar, earlier in his career, when he was, after this, but still earlier in his career, he ran to be Pontifex Maximus, and he had to bribe his way into that office. And on the morning of the election, apparently he said to his mother as he left the house, if I lose this vote, you might not see me again. I'll be done. It means that I won't be able to repay my creditors.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be in fantastic amounts of debt and I won't have a chance of paying it back. So I'm either going to have to skip town or you might just find me dead in an alley. I need to win this. If I don't win the election, I'm screwed. So anyway, just to give you a flavour, that's what happens to Catiline. He runs for a couple of times, borrows fantastically to do it, fails, and now he owes people loads of money and he hasn't even got a high office to show for it. And his enemies, as you said, for those earlier runs in 65, 66 BC, they tried to, well, they did put him on trial for corruption and bribery, right? But he just about got acquitted or got off. So what are your feelings on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, you know, he's sort of, well, he's lost all these elections and he's gone completely bankrupt. He's from a falling aristocratic family that hasn't held consul for many, many years. So he gets very, very desperate to the point where he's willing to forsake Rome for his own personal gain in order to restore that which he had. I think Cicero as well, in one of his speeches, makes a really good point. He illustrates that, you know, Catiline is this man of great wealth. He holds all these, you know, orgies and awful things within his house. But he also still possesses quite a lot of wealth, and he's unwilling to sell that off because of the sort of shame it will bring him, that he's no longer this wealthy sort of figure. He's willing to do anything but to become poor. And that's what you see with the Catiline conspiracy. It illustrates very well that the Roman Republic at this stage is in complete corruptness, that men are no longer, you know, fighting for their principles, and but rather fighting for their self-interest above everything.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of people, they always accuse Catiline of that he's ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
That's what often comes up. It's just the criticism that you're ambitious. These days, that's not really a problem, right? You're almost encouraged to be ambitious and to sort of be a self-publicist and things. Mm-hmm. But in the ancient world or the medieval world, quite often, that was one of the worst sort of vices, to be seen to be ambitious.
Yeah.
But yeah, Catiline's always accused of that. Well, he certainly wanted to be consul and had failed. So he has one last shot at running to be consul in the year 63. And if he won, he would be consul for the year 62.
Mm-hmm.
And he loses again. And Cicero happens to be consul for 63. And so I suppose we could start picking up the story. I've got one quick paragraph here where you mentioned the people he hangs around with and the type of person he is. If I read this paragraph from Sallust, we're told that Catiline was a man of noble birth and of eminent mental and personal endowments, but of a vicious and depraved disposition. His delight from his youth had been civil commotions, bloodshed, robbery, and sedition. I mean, that's pretty bad, isn't it? And in such scenes, he had spent his early years. His constitution could endure hunger, want of sleep, and cold to a degree surpassing belief. His mind was daring, subtle, and versatile, capable of pretending or dissembling whatever he wished. So he's not stupid, right? He was covetous of other men's property and prodigal of his own. He had abundance of eloquence, so he was sharp as well, though but little wisdom. His insatiable ambition was always pursuing objects extravagant, romantic, and unattainable. Great, isn't it, the ancient biographers, how they speak and how they write. But yeah, that gives you an idea, a bit of an idea of the man. So, not stupid, quite a formidable political player, but it seems, if you believe the accounts, just not a good or nice person.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.